Move on now to the 12th study in our series on Monday morning at 10 o'clock here at the Arkansas Camp 1982, just for the tape record. Let's come back now to the 4th chapter of the book of Revelation to continue our consideration of this prophecy which was given to the Apostle John, and therefore, of course, in turn to ourselves. Revelation chapter 4. As we certified yesterday, John was given here a view of the first apartment of the heavenly sanctuary and of the very interesting organizational structure of things in that mighty building, so large it could accommodate 10,000 times 10,000 angels and thousands of thousands, which adds up to something like 100 million plus if we take these as being actual literal figures. And a building of that capacity is certainly not to be found upon this earth today, by no means. We find that the Father is seated upon his throne, and around about him are 24 elders, and around about them in turn there are 4 companies of believers or people signified or symbolized by 4 living creatures. Let's see if we can depict this in some fashion upon the board today. If we draw again the sanctuary, and this of course is a very inadequate representation of a mighty building up in heaven. And there in the first apartment we find the presence of Christ and the Father being on the left and Christ on the Father's right hand, of course, and the 24 elders more or less in a circle around about the Father and the Son, and then one living creature in each of the 4 directions, or one company of people in each of those 4 directions. This has a striking antitypical reproduction of the organization of the camp of ancient Israel. Let's go back for a moment to the book of Numbers to see how the ancient camp of Israel was organized. And we find that it was organized in exactly the same fashion as we have depicted here on the board today. Numbers, the first chapter, first of all. And in this chapter we're twice given a complete list of the children of Israel, although the order is different in the 2 lists. Begin with verse 17. We run down through the various tribes, and I made a list on a pad to save time in reading all these verses. And the list reads: Reuben, Simeon, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Ephraim, Manasseh, Benjamin, Dan, Asher, Gad, and Naphtali. And then when we turn across a little further, we find that when they came to actually number these tribes, that the order was just a little bit different. But what I'm most interested in, though, is the organization of the encampment in chapter 2. Let's start now with verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, Every man of the children of Israel shall pitch by his own standard, with the ensign of their father's house, far off about the tabernacle of the congregation shall they pitch. And on the east side toward the rising of the sun shall they of the standard of the camp of Judah pitch throughout their armies. And Nashon the son of Amminadab shall be captain of the children of Judah. So on the east side of the ancient tabernacle then, we find that Judah was the leading tribe in that position, and the 3 tribes on that side pitched by the standard of Judah. And obviously, what was on the standard of Judah? What symbol? No. A lion, right? This was the lion. Always you find that a lion is a symbol of the tribe of Judah. And when Christ, of course, as the king after the order of Judah came upon the scene, he's called the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And moving on in chapter 2, we find in verse 5 that next to him, that is to Judah, pictures the tribe of Issachar, but there's no mention of a standard or another standard here. Obviously, of course, Judah carries a standard for this group of 3. Here then is the tribe of Issachar, likewise under the standard of the tribe of Judah, which is the lion. And verse 7, then the tribe of Zebulun, and it then gives a number of them and the man who is to be the captain over them. So I'm mainly concerned now with not with those names, but with the disposition of these 3 tribes. That was the eastern arrangement. Now verse 10 brings us around to the south. On the south side should be the standard of the tribe of Reuben according to their armies. So once again we find a standard there is referred to, But try as I might, I've not yet been successful in determining just what that standard is. But there was a standard. And together with Reuben, as you read on, you find Simeon and Gad make up the three tribes down on the south side. And move across to the west. And the west is brought to view in verse 18 and down to verse 24. And who are the three tribes here? On the west side should be the standard of the tribe of the camp of Ephraim, according to their armies. And Ephraim, of course, as you remember, was the elder son of Joseph. Joseph being given a double portion because of his special ministry to the tribe of Israel. And naturally with Ephraim, there was always his brother Manasseh. And the third tribe on the western side was Benjamin. Which again, of course, is very interesting because Joseph and Benjamin had a common mother, didn't they? Who was the common mother of Joseph and Benjamin? Rachel, right? Sarah was the husband, or the wife, I beg your pardon, I'm making mistakes too. Sarah was the wife of Abraham. Very good. Now finally we come to the north side, and we start with Dan in verse 25. The standard of the camp of Dan shall be on the north side by their armies. So now we find that Dan is the standard bearer for the northern part of the encampment. And together with Dan was Asher and Naphtali. And this makes, of course, a total of 12 tribes altogether. Is there any names missing, or is that the total sum of all the tribes? If Joseph got a double portion, there should be 13, right? Whose name is missing? Levi, right? Why is the name of Levi missing? Because they were the unnumbered tribe. Let's turn back to chapter 1, verse 47. But the Levites, after the tribe of their fathers, were not numbered among them. For the Lord had spoken unto Moses, saying, Only thou shalt not number the tribe of Levi, neither take the sum of them among the children of Israel. But thou shalt appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of testimony, and over all the vessels thereof, and over all things belong to it. They shall bear the tabernacle and all the vessels thereof, and they shall minister unto it, and shall encamp round about the tabernacle. Now the last sentence in that verse is the important one. They shall encamp where? Around about the tabernacle. So the Levites then, I haven't left quite enough space here really, but the Levites occupied a position between these tribes and the actual tabernacle. So think of the Levites as symbolized by this red line being encamped close up to and right around the sanctuary, encircling it. And the Levites, of course, were the religious elders of the children of Israel. Now, can you see a very striking similarity between, or an actual reproduction, between the scene depicted up in the heavenly sanctuary when the Father and the Son, which of course was symbolized in the Old Testament sanctuary by the presence of God in the most holy place, are directly surrounded by 24 elders, and then there are four companies of people that surround in an outer circle, just as the 12 tribes of Israel occupied an outer circle beyond that circle of the Levites around the actual building. Now obviously, of course, the organization of the earthly sanctuary and the people of Israel is reproduced in the organization up in the heavenly sanctuary. Can you see the similarity? Right. Now, as I said before, I have been striving for a long time to discover what was on the standard of Reuben and of Ephraim and of Dan. I'm satisfied there are only four standards. Judah was a standard for these three. Reuben's was for these three. Ephraim for these three, and Dan for these three. Each of the tribes did not have its own standard. Only those four leading tribes in those four different directions. Now, one clue which I thought might help us is the fact that in the book of Revelation they're given in a specific order, and the order should coincide with the order given back in the Old Testament. In other words, it is a clockwise direction from the east to the south to the west and back to the north. And Revelation, the order given there, if we turn back to Revelation chapter 4 once more, is a lion, an ox, a man, and an eagle. A lion, an ox, a man, and an eagle. Which would lead us to conclude that the the tribe of Reuben was what? If this was the lion, then came the ox or the calf, called either way. And then what must Ephraim be? A man. And what must Dan be? An eagle. There's a slight problem, however, and the problem lies in the fact that back in the book of Ezekiel, the order is not the same. In Ezekiel, we have a man, a lion, an ox, and an eagle, which reverses things somewhat. If we start with the lion, then the ox, then the eagle, and the man are transposed. The lion and the ox come in the same order, but the eagle and the man are transposed. However, for the moment, the most important thing, of course, is to realize that what God did down upon this earth in typical form is a picture of what God does up in the heavenly organization. And heaven is very much a place of order and organization. While, of course, in heaven, every man is directly connected to the head, which is Jesus Christ, in the truest and most complete sense of that word. Each person has their responsibility. And the 24 elders very obviously have a greater responsibility than the four living creatures who take an outer circle, an outer position in heaven's organization. The position occupied by every individual in God's kingdom is in direct proportion to their capacities. There are statements which tell us that when we come to heaven, we shall be enriched or, to a certain extent, impoverished by the degree to which we've taken advantage of the opportunities given to us down upon this earth. And the service which we begin upon this earth will be picked up and continued when we come to the heavenly mansions. Heaven, of course, is a place of service, of busy activity, of accomplishments, where we'll enjoy carrying out the loftiest and most wonderful aspirations we could imagine. And we turn to the book Education to confirm the fact that in heaven our life will be lives of unlimited and unending service. Page 309 in the book Education. In our life here, earthly, sin-restricted though it is, the greatest joy and the highest education are in service. And in the future state, untrammeled by the limitations of sinful humanity, it is in service that our greatest joy and our highest education will be found, witnessing. And ever as we witness, learning anew the riches of the glory of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. If our minds go back for a moment to the organization of heaven, in fact the entire universe, we find that God has made every living thing to serve every other living thing. Let's read some of the beautiful words in this connection back in the book Desire of Ages, in that glorious chapter entitled God with Us, which of course is the interpretation of the name Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us. I start back on page 19, where it says, by coming to dwell with us, Jesus was to reveal God both to men and to angels. He was the Word of God, God's thought made audible. In his prayer for his disciples, he says, I have declared unto them thy name, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, that the love wherewith thou hast loved me may be in them and I in them. But not alone for his earth-born children was this revelation given. Our little world is the lesson book of the universe. God's wonderful purpose of grace, the mystery of redeeming love, is the theme into which angels desire to look, and it will be their study throughout endless ages. Both the redeemed and the unformed beings will find in the cross of Christ their science and their song. They will find in the cross of Christ their science and their song. What is the difference between a science and a song? Let's take the word song first. When you sing, what do you usually do? Express praise, express thankfulness, or you express your emotions. Isn't that right? Now, what will be the dominant emotion that we shall experience up in heaven? Joy and praise. So as we, for eternity, contemplate the cross of Calvary, which is the ultimate manifestation of unselfish love or of self-sacrificing service, as we see that demonstration, it will bring forth in us unending songs of praise. And we shall find in the cross of Christ our song. Now, what about our science? What does the word science mean? What do sciences tell you? Right, how, why, and when? What about where? Right, a science is the revelation of procedures. Sciences are ways of doing things, right? The Spirit of Prophecy talks about the science of salvation, by which we understand, of course, that we're talking in the science of salvation about the procedures or the steps or the work which must be done in that science to bring about or to effect salvation. So therefore, the cross of Calvary will be our science, or it will be the revelation to us of the way of life that we, even in heaven, are to live. And that's confirmed now as you read a little further. It will be seen. And now this next sentence is an enlargement on what has just been said, where we read that they will find in the cross of Christ their science and their song, and in doing that, it will be seen that the glory shining in the face of Jesus is the glory of self-sacrificing love. In the light from Calvary, it will be seen that the law of self-renouncing love is the law of life for earth and heaven. That the love which seeketh not her own has a source in the heart of God, and that in the meek and lowly one is manifested the character of him who dwelleth in the light which no man can approach unto. Many people have the idea that down upon this earth we take up the cross and we follow Jesus. And that's true, we do. And they look forward to that glad day, as they think, when they'll lay down the cross and take up the crown. But the cross of Jesus is an eternal principle. When man sinned, or before man ever sinned, let's go back to the very beginning of it, and long before man sinned, and when God made the first creatures, the first angels, the first dwellers on distant planets, there then arose the need for someone to stand in the position of a connector between the eternal and infinite source, which is God the Father, the beginner of all things, and the creatures. Now when Jesus Christ became the begotten Son of God, and took upon his divinity the limitations of the angelic form, then was that not an act of self-sacrificing love? Absolutely. A tremendous condescension. A stepping down from the highest to a much lower level in order to bring service and fellowship and joy and life to unnumbered millions of God's created beings. Now when Jesus Christ did that, he took up his cross. And there was no difference in essence or quality between that action back there when Christ took that lower level to serve than when he died upon Calvary's cross to serve. There was no difference. The cross was only taking the same thing a long way further. And so when Christ came down to reveal the character of God, when Christ came down to minister to perishing mankind, all this was the outworking of that law of self-sacrificing love, which is the law of life for heaven as well as for this earth. Now I read further. In the beginning, God was revealed in all the works of creation. It was Christ that spread the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth. It was his hand that hung the worlds in space and fashioned the flowers of the field. His strength setteth fast the mountains. The sea is his, and he made it. It was he who filled the earth with beauty and the air with song. And upon all things in earth and air and sky, he wrote the message of the Father's love. Now sin has marred God's perfect work, yet the handwriting remains. Even now, all created things declare the glory of his excellence. There is nothing save the selfish heart of man that lives unto itself. No bird that cleaves the air, no animal that moves upon the ground but ministers to some other life. There is no leaf of the forest or lowly blade of grass but has its ministry. Every tree and shrub and leaf pours forth that element of life without which neither man nor animal could live. And man and animal in turn minister to the life of tree and shrub and leaf. The flowers breathe fragrance and unfold their beauty and blessing to the world. The sun sheds its light to gladden a thousand worlds. The ocean, itself the source of all our springs and fountains, receives the streams from every land that takes to give. The mist ascending from its bosom fall in showers to water the earth that it may bring forth and bud. Now this paragraph so far talks about things as they remain in this sinful world, because despite the presence of sin, the handwriting of Jesus Christ the Creator still remains upon this earth. And nature, as you study it, certainly reveals the fact that every leaf and tree and shrub, every animal, every bird, every insect lives to serve other organisms and other creatures throughout the entire world. And the more, of course, we contemplate this unending life of service on the part of all these creatures, the more we are stimulated and inspired to the study of nature to do likewise, very obviously. Now, the character of God is written very large in nature. Certainly, of course, sin has stamped itself upon nature as well. In the wild storms and destructive elements, we see the handwriting of sin. But at the same time, we see there the handwriting of God as well. And very often those wild storms that do so much damage also bring tremendous blessings to the landscape as well. But now, turning from these earthly representations, the paragraph moves on to the work of the angels. And here we find, next to the self-sacrificing life of Jesus Christ, something worthy of our praise, our appreciation, and our emulation. Let's read now from page 21 in the book Desire of Ages. The angels of glory find their joy in giving, giving love and tireless watch care to souls who are fallen and unholy. Heavenly beings woo the hearts of men. They bring to this dark world light from the courts above by gentle and patient ministry. They move upon the human spirit to bring the lost into a fellowship with Christ which is even closer than they themselves can know. We've learned from our previous studies, of course, that when the redeemed are finally ushered through the pearly gates and given their beautiful mansions above, that they'll occupy a position higher than the angels can ever know. Now, that, of course, will be wonderful enough. But think of the fact, meditate upon the truth, that the angels will have worked tirelessly, devotedly, self-sacrificingly to actually put us in a position higher than themselves. Is that loving service? Beautiful, isn't it? Wonderful must be the character of those angels. I think upon the fact that they have been servants of God for millions of years, billions upon billions of years, no doubt, maybe trillions upon trillions of years. They're extremely old, but still, of course, as young as ever. That's a nice thought, isn't it? How would you like to be 10 trillion years of age and yet be as young as a youth still? Glorious. And that, of course, is the prospect we have before us in the heavenly home when that time comes. Now think by contrast to the prodigal son's brother. When this young man had gone away to Egypt and wasted his inheritance and came back again, and the father pulled out the best robe and killed the fatted calf, what did the other brother say? This is a fine state of affairs. Here I have been faithfully working for you all this time, and I've never had the fatted calf killed for me. I've never had the golden ring upon my finger. I've never had the seat of honor at a feast given by my father. And that prodigal son's brother exhibited the kind of spirit the angels could exhibit, because they could say, look how faithfully we have served you all these trillions of years. We have never rebelled. We've stood beside you when others did rebel. We have done your work faithfully. We have never quarreled or done anything wrong. And we've never been given a position like these folk are being given. Can't you see how easily the angels of God could express jealousy and discontent over God's works for mankind? But they don't, because implanted within them is the spirit of self-sacrificing service, which is the law of life for heaven and earth. But before them, of course, is the eternal example of Jesus Christ himself. I now read on page 21 these wonderful words. But turning from all lesser representations, we behold God in Jesus. Looking unto Jesus, we see that it is the glory of our God to give. I do nothing of myself, said Christ. The living Father hath sent me, and I live by the Father. I seek not mine own glory, but the glory of him that sent me. In these words is set forth the great principle, which is the law of life for the universe. All things Christ received from God, but he took to give. So in the heavenly courts, in his ministry for all created beings, through the beloved Son, the Father's life flows out to all. Through the Son it returns in praise and joyous service, a tide of love to the great source of all. It is thus through Christ the circuit of beneficence is complete. representing the character of the great giver, the law of life. Now what a beautiful paragraph this is. It says, we'll take some of the main sentences again. It says, all things Christ received from God, but he took to give. So in the heavenly courts, in his ministry for all created beings, through the beloved Son, the Father's life flows out to all. So therefore, what is Christ? The great connector. Through him it flows out to all, and through him it returns in praise and joyous service, a tide of love to the great source of all. Heaven must be a beautiful place. It really must. And I guess we can't wait to get there, can we? But there's work to do in the meantime, there's service to perform in the meantime. And if today God should come down and offer any one of us a direct pathway to heaven, then if we were actuated by the spirit of divine love or true fitness to go there, what would we do? We'd refuse it. Why? Because we couldn't go there, we couldn't let ourselves be taken there until the work is finished down here upon this earth, the work which God can do only through consecrated human channels. And I know I wouldn't want to go to heaven right now, not until the work which God has given me to do is finished. Then I wouldn't mind. But in the meantime, it would be a very unhappy solution to offer a person. Now, from this great truth that every one of us is called to a position of service, and right now, of course, our service mainly is serving in school, learning, and preparing for a future work. That's very much a part of the service program. Day by day, we have the opportunity, of course, of manifesting the spirit of loving service in our daily contacts with people. But the greatest opportunities for self-sacrificing service before the Lord shall return will come to us during the loud cry period and during the ministry of the fifth, sixth, and seventh angels beyond the close of probation. And we will have tremendous opportunities then, opportunities so great and at the same time so terrifying that some of us will feel like drawing back when that time comes. Let me read to you from the book Great Controversy, a statement which pictures the time when the saints of God will wish they had not spoken out, they had not declared the words which God gave them, they had been more judicious and careful rather than getting themselves into such a terrible mess as they have gotten themselves into. I turn now to the book Great Controversy, page 608 and 609, where I read these words, In this time of persecution, the faith of the Lord's servants will be tried. They have faithfully given the warning, looking to God and to his word alone. God's Spirit, moving upon their hearts, has constrained them to speak. Stimulated with holy zeal and with the divine impulse strong upon them, they entered upon the performance of their duties without coldly calculating the consequences of speaking to the people the word which the Lord has given them. They have not consulted their temporal interests, nor sought to preserve their reputation or their lives. Yet, when the storm of persecution, of opposition and reproach bursts upon them, some, overwhelmed with consternation, will be ready to exclaim, had we foreseen the consequence of our words, we would have held our peace. So, when we come to realize the extent of the sacrifice called for in that final service, what will some of us wish? That's why we said nothing at all. Preserve our lives from the fearful peril that self-sacrificing service will bring back upon our own heads. But as the power of God goes on to say, of course, the people of God will remain strong and true, and they will not surrender their principles, but will be faithful to God right through to the bitter end. Now, I'd like to bring a very practical lesson from this principle of self-sacrificing service. It's a principle which I have found to be the perfect cure for any taking of offense against anything that other people may do to us at any time whatsoever. Now, when people come and they don't treat us the way we would like to be treated and the way we think we ought to be treated, how do we generally respond? We respond by being offended, by being upset. We complain about the way in which others have treated us and so forth, and we completely fail to recognize that how other people treat us is not to be our concern in the slightest degree whatsoever. In the great judgment day, you will have to answer for your actions, not the other person's actions toward you. your actions toward him and your reactions toward him, you must answer for, not what he does to you. And therefore, if we'll develop in our minds the attitude, how the other person treats me doesn't matter in the slightest. He can call me bad names, he can disinherit me, he can forsake me, he can ridicule me, he can even kill me. But that's what he has to answer for, not you. What you have to answer for is how you treat him. Now when, for instance, a person comes to you and insults you, and that insult develops in you a spirit of retaliation, then you can rejoice at this experience. That man literally has been behaving toward you as a friend, although it's not the way you think a friend should behave toward you, because his actions has provided a source of temptation which reveals to you something you didn't know about as being there previously, but which you, now that you can see it, you have the privilege, of course, of being rid of it. Let me read now a statement on page 110 in the book Mount of Blessing, which confirms this thought. The first part, of course, is just leading up to my main sentence, which I'll come to in just a moment. If you have renounced self and given yourself to Christ, you are a member of the family of God, and everything in the Father's house is for you. All the treasures of God are open to you, both the world that now is and that which is to come. The ministry of angels, the gift of His Spirit, the labors of His servants, all are for you. The world with everything in it is yours so far as it can do you good. And now comes the main sentence up to which I'm leading. Even the enmity of the wicked will prove a blessing by disciplining you for heaven. If you're Christ, all things are yours. So what then is the enmity of the wicked toward you? A blessing. Is that hard to appreciate and see? Certainly is, isn't it? We tend to think of the enmity of the wicked as something to be hated and shunned, but if we receive that as a ministry unto us and recognize that what that generates in us is a revelation of what we are, which revelation can cause us gratitude and thankfulness, or for what God has done in us, or gratitude and thankfulness if we can see what we need to have done in us. Either way, it's a blessing. So in short, if our friends or our enemies insult us, and that does not bring out of us an evil response, but only a love response, rejoice, because then you can see what God has already done for you. If it does bring an evil response, rejoice again, because now you see yourself, and you have the opportunity of giving up that which you see, and having it replaced, of course, by the divine qualities of love, joy, peace, gentleness, meekness, and so forth. So then, we are in this world today to serve, and we shall go to heaven in turn to continue that service. The service we begin here is but the preparation for the higher service to be engaged in the heavenly courts. Let me read again this thought from page 309 in the book Education. In our life here, earthly, sin-restricted though it is, the greatest joy and the highest education are in service. And in the future state, and trammeled by the limitations of sinful humanity, it is in service that our greatest joy and our highest education will be found, witnessing, and ever as we witness, learning anew the riches of the glory of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Now the previous page talks about the fact that the redeemed will have a contribution to make to the unfallen angels and all the rest of the unfallen beings throughout the universe, which only they can make because of the personal experience they have had in the actual conflict with sin. They have wrought with Christ, and as even the angels could not do, have entered into the fellowship of His sufferings. And so they'll have a testimony to the science of redemption, which will be of tremendous value to the unfallen beings. Now we have looked so far in Revelation chapter 4 to this divine arrangement. We find the Father and the Son surrounded by 24 elders and by four groups of living beings whom we have come to learn as being the redeemed from this earth, taken up when Christ went back to heaven after His crucifixion and resurrection. I want now to extend this thought a little further, this thought of service. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 5 verse 10. And we find that here is a testimony given by these 24 elders, which include, of course, Enoch, Moses, and Elijah, and the four groups of living creatures which surround the throne of God and of Jesus Christ. And they say, after having testified that they have been redeemed to God from out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, they say, and has made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. Back in Revelation, the first chapter, and verse 6, we find the same testimony given by John the Beloved, and hath made us kings and priests unto God and his Father, to him be glory and dominion for ever and ever. On this earth, we sometimes have empty titles. People are called so-and-so or such-and-such, and the thing is as empty as can be. For instance, the Queen of England today has an empty title, virtually speaking. She's not really a queen in the sense of being a queen. She doesn't run the country. The Parliament, which is the equivalent of your Congress, runs the country, and the Queen just signs documents as a mere figurehead. It's an empty title. But when God gives to his people in the eternity yet to come the titles of kings and priests, will those be empty titles or actual positions? Actual positions. We read from Daniel, of course, Daniel chapter 7, I think yesterday, the fact that the entire kingdom under the whole heaven should be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, and so on. But people say to me, well, what point is there for a priesthood in the eternity to come when there's no more sin for a priest to minister about? Well, it's true that in the coming eternity there'll be no more sin. That's obviously true. Fortunately, too, because this long 6,000 years plus the final showdown at the end of the 7,000th year will eliminate sin totally, root and branch, from the universe, and we are glad to know that. But when you go back and consider the work of a priest, we'll find that only a small proportion of the priest's work in the Old Testament period was a ministry for sin. By far the larger part was education. Because who were the teachers in Israel? The priests were. They taught the people. And secondly, another very large part of the priest's work was that of leadership in worship. Now, once we come to heaven, will the angels and the unformed beings have attained to ultimate education? Will they know everything? Certainly not. They certainly will not. Throughout the entire length and breadth of eternity, the beings throughout the universe will study the plan of salvation. It will be their science and their song. They'll desire to look deeper and deeper into these wonderful and glorious mysteries, and so will they redeem themselves. Now, of all the beings, apart from the Godhead, all the created beings, the most qualified to teach and educate in this field will be ourselves, that is, the redeemed, who, because we have been personally involved with Jesus Christ in the work of redemption, because we have been in the pit of sin and known the power of sin, the hopelessness of it and the blackness of it and the despair of it, and have experienced the saving power of God to lift us out of that pit of sin, to transform us and give us victory over sin even in this environment down here, in this life down here, and then we have known the exaltation of the seed of Christ from the lowest possible levels of degradation to the highest possible levels of exaltation, where we actually sit with Christ in his throne, then because of this personal experience, the redeemed will have qualifications as teachers that nobody else could ever possibly have. Now, for instance, who would you like to have for your geography teacher to teach you all about, shall we say, Africa or Europe? A person who had only read about Africa and Europe from books and never been there, or a teacher who had been in those countries and spent many, many years traveling up and down, talking with the people, working in the different jobs in those countries, and so he knew that country by first-hand experience, which would you rather have for your geography teacher? The answer is obvious, isn't it? And likewise, up in the heavenly courts, the angels recognize that the redeemed will have qualifications which no other beings in the universe can have apart from Jesus Christ himself. Let me now actually read those words to you on page 308 in the book Education. For what was the great controversy permitted to continue throughout the ages? Why was it that Satan's existence was not cut short at the outset of his rebellion? It was that the universe might be convinced of God's justice in dealing with evil, the sin might receive eternal condemnation. In the plan of redemption, there are heights and depths that eternity itself can never exhaust, marvels into which the angels desire to look. They're eager students. And now Sister White says, the redeemed only. Now, what does that make them to be? An exclusive class, doesn't it? Right? The redeemed only of all created beings have in their own experience known the actual conflict with sin. They have wrought with Christ, as even the angels could not do, have entered into the fellowship of his sufferings. Now the question, will they have no testimony as to the science of redemption, nothing that will be of worth to unfallen beings? And what is the answer? The question is, will they have no testimony? They will have a tremendous testimony. Will they have nothing that will be of worth to unfallen beings? They'll have a tremendous contribution to make because of the personal experience to which they have passed. In this life, we are called into God's army to serve. And our only thought should be from day to day is, what does God wish me to do today in order to serve my fellow men? That's the only thought. We are not to concern ourselves with service of other people to us. We have to accept what we get, and what we don't get, we are not to worry about, because we are to answer only for our own responsibilities and not the responsibilities of others. We'll develop this thought a little further in our next study period, as our time has now gone for this one.